asking if we were related. Early in June, my mother called me at work and said excitedly that she had received a letter from an astrologer friend in New York, a letter mentioning her firstborn, me. I was supposed to have great success in the future, involving a door opening for me that had previously been closed. Apparently, the woman had been very accurate with her predictions in the past. I never paid much heed to such matters, and was more concerned with finishing my second novel, The Garbage Chronicles, which was near completion. I wanted to show it to my father that weekend, and had worked long hours, including a marathon Thursday night until 3:30 a.m., allowing only 3 hours before going to the office. There had been more work remaining in the book than I had anticipated, but I pushed all the way through to the end. 402 pages. In the process, I created some pretty unusual characters, including one I really liked, a young magical comet named Wizzy. One of the chapters was based upon an unpublished short story I had written the year before, Earth Games. I was a zombie at work the next day. When I next saw my father in Port Townsend, he said everything was progressing on the Dune movie, although he had no idea who would star in it. Apparently, the desert scenes would not be filmed in either of the most frequently rumored locations, Tunisia or China's Gobi Desert. The latest plan called for using a giant World War II blimp hangar in England, the interior of which would be converted into a desert. My parents were flying to Universal Studios in Los Angeles in a few days to talk with director David Lynch and Rafaela De Laurentiis, Dino De Laurentiis's daughter. She had been put in charge of the film by her father. Dad was looking forward to a 10-day fishing trip in Alaska with his first cousin, Ken Roundtree Jr., and a friend, Jim McCarran. They planned to leave at the end of June, my father's first real vacation in 10 years. He went to bed at 8:30 p.m., taking my just-completed manuscript with him. In the morning, he cooked blueberry pancakes and prepared fresh juice, a tasty mixture of orange and grapefruit. We were talking about vitamins and nutrients, and Dad said that British seamen, limeys, discovered they could avoid scurvy by drinking lime juice. They used to drink it with rum, he said. Sounds like a daiquiri, Mom quipped. After breakfast, Dad said, let's talk story. The two of us took my manuscript in the living room and spread it out on the coffee table. I didn't get very far last night, Dad said, while my heart hammered in trepidation. But far enough to see that you've really improved. He had read the first chapter. We worked all day, both of us sitting on the black vinyl couch. He made corrections here and there and passed the pages on to me. At times as he read, he would take deep breaths and pick at his ear, and I tried to determine whether these were signs of boredom or fatigue. 5 or 6 times he laughed boisterously, once at a passage that was not intended to be funny. At other times he would slouch back on the couch and drop his right arm to his side, in apparent disbelief. Sometimes he would stack pages neatly after reading them on the cushion between us. Other times he would slam them down or hand them to me one at a time. He didn't say anything, just kept reading, and most of the signs seemed bad. It was hot in the house, and as the session proceeded, I became sticky with perspiration, partly from nervousness, no doubt. We could hear the excited squeals of the children as they swam with Jan and Mom. By 6 p.m., Dad had read 328 of the 402 pages, with a couple of breaks. Once he sat back and closed his eyes. Within seconds, he was asleep, an enviable ability of his to nap anywhere. We drove to the Harbormaster restaurant in Port Ludlow. Fortunately, we got a nice corner window table with a view of the yacht harbor. Dad was not familiar with a particular selection on the wine list, a 1978 Mount Veeder Cabernet Sauvignon. He was afraid it might be too young, but decided it was probably okay since it was from California. It turned out to be very good. Dad said a British publisher had made an unprecedented offer for United Kingdom book rights on The White Plague, higher even than he had received for any Dune book. Knowing he was hard at work on a book with Bill Ransom and had Dune 5 to do after that, I asked him if he couldn't take life a little easier. He said Mom's illness had cut 5.5 months out of his writing time, and they had some huge bills to pay for the construction in Hawaii. He's always worked hard, Mom said. Jan toasted my new novel, The Garbage Chronicles, and to my relief, Dad commented, it's very good. Mom mentioned that Bill Ransom and my father were writing alternate chapters in a leapfrog method, and that she never had been able to tell who wrote which chapter. "Bill has a smooth writing style," she said. They were going better than anticipated, and now expected to complete the Lazarus Effect in August. Keeping his voice from carrying to other tables, Dad told me how much he expected to earn the coming year, a seven-figure income that was equal to his entire net worth. In 1 year, he would earn the equivalent of what it had taken him an entire lifetime to accumulate. 3 days later, they flew to Los Angeles to visit Universal Studios and see how the Dune movie was going. In the process, my father lost another week from his writing schedule. While they were gone, I finished The Garbage Chronicles and mailed it to Clyde Taylor in New York City. After my parents returned, Dad was anxious to get back to his study, but Mom needed still another checkup with a heart specialist at Group Health Hospital. With all the ferry rides, this would cost him yet another day. But my mother arranged with a pilot friend, Graham Newell, to fly her in a small plane from Port Townsend to the Bellevue airfield near our house. Jan picked Mom up in Bellevue and took her to the hospital, and then back to our house afterward. I arrived home at shortly past 5 p.m., just in time to take Mom to the airport for her return flight to Port Townsend. Kim went with us and gave her Nana a heart pendant necklace that she bought with her allowance. Kim, now 10, had lost a molar tooth that day, and for the first time said she no longer believed in the tooth fairy. Tremendously excited about the movie, Mom described meetings at Universal Studios with David Lynch and Rafaela De Laurentiis, discussing cuts that might be needed in the film to keep it under budget. Lynch was having trouble with cuts to his baby, so my father, after praising the work he had done, offered to help. One evening, Dad worked at the studio editing the script, after which he and my mother went to a late dinner with Rafaela and David. Frank Herbert's changes were incorporated into the screenplay, which would ultimately go into a sixth draft. In all, he cut 14 pages of material, resulting in a savings of $14 million in the budget. $1 million a page. They had discussions about giving my father a share of the screenplay credit, but he wouldn't hear of it, saying he felt David and his associates deserved it for doing such a masterful job. He would accept a consulting fee only. Rafaela De Laurentiis showed my parents a series of storyboards that had been prepared by the art department, pictorial instructions for the positioning of actors in key scenes. It was an intriguing process to Beverly Herbert. All of the castle scenes, for example, would be filmed at once, no matter where they appeared in the story. Then they would tear the castle set down and build another one. It would be extremely costly if they forgot to shoot a scene and had to rebuild the set. After all the filming, the scenes were pieced together where needed in the film editing process. An air of secrecy surrounded the production. Lynch, who referred to his scriptwriting team of Eric Berggren and Christopher DeVore as the Great Team, wrote regular memos to them. During the first 3 days of June 1982, his transmittals included this: "Any leaks concerning what we are doing on this project will decrease the curiosity factor and cause us to lose power. I beg you to keep this in mind." My mother found it all fascinating, but beneath her excitement, I heard layered sadness and concern. She was wondering if she would live long enough to see the film. I prayed that she would. Much later, I ran across an entry in her travel journal from that Los Angeles trip on binder paper. It comprised less than one page and revealed all the excitement of a schoolgirl confiding in her diary. "I can't believe it's really going to happen." She didn't have the energy to write more. A few days later, I spoke with Dad about his upcoming fishing trip to Alaska. "I don't know if I'm going," he said, and refused to discuss it further. I knew he felt run down by what he'd been through, all the writing deadlines, the movie, the non-stop work, and the care he'd given to my mother. He needed that vacation desperately, had been looking forward to it for months. But Mom's latest medical tests had been so bad, showing a continuing downhill slide, that he thought he shouldn't go after all. To save the fishing trip, Mom wondered if Jan could come to Port Townsend and stay with her. But Jan was having her difficulties at Cornish Institute, where she was hanging on by a thread. These troubles had been caused in part by her concern over Mom, and in part by the demands of taking care of the baby. Her grades had been falling, and she couldn't afford to miss any more classes. In a telephone conversation, my father revealed to Jan that Mom wanted only her there in his absence. No one else who lived nearby would do. Without approval from the school, Jan promised she would be in Port Townsend the next day. After catching the first ferry from Seattle to Bainbridge Island, she called the school. The director said he understood, that he realized she had to take her chances and go. But he made no promises. Dad waited until Jan arrived before leaving on his trip. He told her he felt bad for her having to leave school, but said he needed to get away. Jan told him not to worry, that it was all worked out at school. This was not true, of course. Their first evening together, Mom did needlepoint while she and Jan talked in the living room about what was going on in their lives. Dad had found a new high-carbohydrate diet that was supposed to stop his chronic jet lag, and he was going to test it during the Alaska trip. Mom spoke as well about her best friend in high school and college, Frankie Goodwin, how they would exchange worries to relieve the burden of them. "I'll take your worries if you take mine," one girl would say to the other, and then they would trade. They called it the worry game. "Why don't we do that now?" Jan suggested. Mom smiled and said softly, "All right." Jan did not mention her concerns about school and spoke instead of worries about how our daughters would grow up and who they might marry, and her hope that I might do well enough in my writing to leave the insurance business, since it seemed to her that I was wearing myself out writing and working full-time to support a family. Mom spoke of her illness and again of her concern over what might happen to Dad if she passed away. She said she'd been staying awake worrying about bills again, how they would be paid, and how she would get the energy to make sure the checks were sent out, and all the filing and letter writing she had to do. She said while she was in the hospital or at doctor's appointments, Dad moved funds between their various accounts, leaving a bewildering trail she couldn't follow. He told her that he had issued important checks, paying mortgages, construction bills, and other things. But she couldn't figure out which accounts had been used for what, and if they were the correct accounts. Now there were piles of unpaid bills, bills the Dad hadn't gotten around to paying because he was preparing for his trip and meeting writing deadlines. He kept assuring her the money she needed for bills was available and there was nothing to worry about. But to her, their cash flow and cash-on-hand positions were not clear, and she didn't have the energy to figure it all out. Bills flowed in constantly. Big ones. "Why don't you hire an accountant?" Jan suggested. "Then what would I do? This is my job." The next day, Jan pulled two chairs up to Mom's desk and said, "We'll just sit here and figure it out together." Jan looked over the ledgers and made a telephone call, with Mom, to a banker, obtaining current bank balances. Jan couldn't quite figure it all out and needed to ask Dad questions. But plenty of money seemed to be in the accounts, and she said to Mom, "You tell me who to write the checks to and out of what account." And every day with my mother, Jan helped her organize and pay the bills. In this process, Jan felt frustrated that she could not do nearly enough, that she was like the little Dutch boy holding a finger in a massive dike. And anything she did was just stopgap, didn't really solve anything. So much more needed to be done for Mom. And Jan realized her own frustration must be minor compared with Dad's feelings. Mom was too weak to cook, so Jan did it all, as Dad had done in recent months. Jan put her mother-in-law to bed, laid an electric blanket over her and set it up, brought her glasses of water and books. All the things Dad had been doing. Some days they painted together, landscapes of the gardens, the duck pond, the tall, graceful trees around the property, the flowers. Or they went to the beach and took their paints and a picnic lunch along. On large sheets of newsprint, my mother showed Jan how her mother, a professional artist, had taught her to draw large scale without looking at the page, keeping her eyes glued on whatever she was painting. While Dad was in Alaska, Mom received a dramatic cover art poster from New York for The White Plague, which was soon to be released. It depicted a lush green Irish countryside, a dark stormy sky, and a giant double helix in the foreground. Dad had hoped to see the cover art before he left, but it hadn't arrived in time. Mom said she was putting it up in a prominent position on the kitchen bulletin board, so Dad would be sure to see it the minute he came in the door. Mom gave me a phone number so that I could reach my father in Alaska at his fish camp near Lake Creek, which was actually a river. She said it was a radio telephone connection in which only one person could talk at a time. When one spoke, it cut the line off for the other. Dad told her he was catching a lot of king salmon and rainbow trout and throwing them back for the sport of it. He quipped that mosquitoes there were so big that four of them marked one fisherman with pheromones, external hormones, and carried him off. They dropped him when they saw a bigger, juicier fisherman. To thwart this danger, Dad claimed he wore a scuba diver's weight belt while fishing. On the morning of the July day that Dad was due back from Alaska, Mom said she hadn't slept well, worrying if everything would be just right for him when he returned. She and Jan were sitting in dark yellow recliner chairs in a reading and television area just off the kitchen, with a table full of books and mail-order catalogs between them. "Could you make Frank a special meal?" Mom asked. "He really likes the barbecued spare rib recipe you gave me." Jan went through two big boxes of recipe cards and found one in her own handwriting, from which she made the ribs. As soon as Dad phoned from the airport to say he would be home in a couple of hours, Jan left, so that my parents could share the meal in private. When Dad arrived, he was so engrossed with having missed Mom that he didn't notice the giant bright green poster for the white plague. It was clearly visible, just inside the entry. Not until hours later, after he had savored the spare ribs and was cleaning up in the kitchen, did he see it. "When I think of how my parents felt for one another, about the depth of their love, this incident comes quickly to mind. No matter the glory my father achieved from writing, no matter how many millions of people read his books, it all meant nothing to him without her." Chapter 33. The White Plague is Taking Off. Early in July 1982, my parents announced that they were leaving for a month in Hawaii the following day, a decision they had made on the spur of the moment. At a hastily arranged dinner in Seattle just before their departure, Dad told us in a sharp, angry voice about the difficulties they were having finding low-salt foods for my mother in restaurants and grocery stores, and how frustrating it was. Salt was everywhere in the American diet, he said, and much of the blame had to do with the ignorance of the medical profession. Doctors knew too little about diet, and not enough meaningful research was being conducted about the benefits and dangers of particular foods and diets. While Dad was taking care of Mom, Penny was trying to keep Bruce, now 31 years old, out of trouble. An incurable disease had recently been discovered that was killing homosexual men. AIDS. From her home in Stockton, California, Penny telephoned Bruce in San Rafael near San Francisco. The most thoughtful and generous person in our family, Penny was always sending us notes and little gifts. Now, with her stepmother seriously ill and weakened, Penny tried to be a mother figure to Bruce, providing him with important advice. She warned him about the dangers in the homosexual community from the new disease, and cautioned him against having unprotected sex and relationships with multiple partners. Like the rest of us in the family, she wished he wasn't homosexual at all. We were all worried about him. Bruce promised to be careful. Later that summer, after my parents returned, Jan, Julie, and I borrowed the Caladan and took it on a week-long sailing trip to the San Juan Islands, along with one of Jan's brothers, Ron Blanke, and his wife. It was a great trip, with beautiful weather and excellent winds. When we returned to the Port Townsend Yacht Club, however, I didn't back the boat in the way Dad wanted it done. Backing confused me, so I took it in bow first. Dad was on the dock watching, shaking his head in disapproval. After we disembarked, he boarded the sailboat and restarted the engine. "Release the lines," he shouted. This was done, and he pulled the Caladan out, then turned it around quickly and backed it toward the slip. But he came in at the wrong angle, and too fast. The dock and boat were about to merge when Julie saved the day with quick thinking. At the last possible opportunity, the 14-year-old threw a line from the boat around a cleat on the dock and heaved on it as hard as she could. Subsequently, all of us, especially my father, acted as if nothing had happened. At Xanadu, Mom said her fingernails had been flaking lately, and she was not sure why. I said nothing about it, but worried that it might be an indication of her condition. When she tried to swim the length of the pool, she only made it 3/4 of the way on her own. Dad walked alongside the pool by her as she swam, and dove in quickly to help her finish. The following Thursday, I telephoned to see how she was doing, and she said, "I'm bearing up. Frank took me swimming this morning." My mother went on to talk about her jewelry insurance, which I was handling for her. She had a valuable Cortina quartz watch with a gold band, a gift from Dad during one of their European trips, and she told me what amount to use in insuring it. Recently, she took the watch to a jeweler and had one of the links in the band taken out so that it would fit better. Her wrist was much smaller from all the weight she had lost. My mother had bookkeeping ledgers spread before her as she talked, and gave me a couple of tips about looking for errors in the books, how to tell if a figure had been transposed, and if an amount had been moved from debit to credit by mistake. Sometime that summer, my father and mother stopped by our house for a short visit. I recall standing in bright sunlight with him in the backyard. He spoke about the beauty of Kauala and the perfect Hawaiian weather. "There's a certain kind of warmth you get from the sun that you don't get anywhere else," he said. These words conveyed another message, that the paradise he had provided for Mom in Hawaii had become his as well. It more or less sealed what I already knew and feared, that one day they would finally decide to sell the Port Townsend property and live year-round in Hawaii. In September, Dad went on a big book tour to promote the hardcover edition of The White Plague. Chauffeured limousines picked up my parents in every city on the tour, and huge crowds greeted Dad at every public appearance. By the 27th of the month, the tour was wrapping up, and he was scheduled to appear in Seattle. Jan and I met my parents at the Seattle Times at 11:30 a.m., where Dad had just been interviewed by the newspaper's book editor. A limousine provided by Putnam took us to a posh restaurant in downtown Seattle. I brought along their insurance files to review at the table. "The White Plague is taking off," Dad said, as he broke open a French roll. I said I hoped he meant the book, and not the plague germ that would wipe out all womankind on the planet. This elicited a hearty guffaw from him. Dad's beard was neatly trimmed, shorter than usual, and he was ebullient. He was having the absolute best time of his life, at the height of his success. To crown it, Mom had been strong all through the tour, and said she was feeling good. The novel had gotten rave reviews from a number of prestigious publications, Dan said, including the New York Times. It was his sixth national bestseller. Children of Dune, The Dosadi Experiment, God Emperor of Dune, and The White Plague had all appeared on weekly bestseller lists. Dune and Dune Messiah were bestsellers as well, from a groundswell that built up over years. Each title in the Dune series sold millions of copies, and the canvas of his imagination kept getting bigger. All Frank Herbert books were selling exceptionally well, with so many reprints of old titles all over the world that it was difficult to keep up with sales figures. At one of the stores on the tour, a frail old woman in her 90s brought Dad a hardcover first edition copy of Dune, a collector's edition. She placed it before him, and leaning close by his ear, whispered in a crackling voice, "Write something dirty in the book for me, please." Dad's eyes twinkled as he caught her gaze, and he thought for a moment. Then he wrote, "Something dirty," and signed his name. Another time, Dad actually did write a profanity alongside his signature in a book he gave to a friend. It had been an impulsive prank, but subsequently he felt guilty for it and sent the friend a substitute copy, more properly autographed. Occasionally, very rarely, readers would come to Dad with criticisms, some involving major plot points. Dad always smiled pleasantly and said, "Why don't you go write your own book?" Despite brisk book sales, my parents were still having trouble keeping up with ongoing construction expenses at Kauala. They were drawing up plans for an apartment wing to be built next, and a swimming pool was planned soon after that. A number of the estimates they had received for construction were proving to be woefully low, and they didn't have a written contract to keep costs down. Even if they'd had a contract, Dad said, it wouldn't mean much because of the number of changes he kept making in the design during construction. In early October, Mom prepared a special birthday meal for Dad, oysters from nearby Quilcene Bay and wild blackberry pie. She said the oysters, as she prepared them, were a favorite of his, and I made notes on how to do it. After work the following Monday, I worked at the public library on a new nonfiction book I was writing about how to deal with dishonest businessmen, which I entitled The Client's Survival Manual. When I arrived home, Julie said there was an article on her grandfather pinned to a library wall at her high school. It was next to a large paper fish. Proudly, Julie told a friend, "That's my grandpa on the wall there." "That fish?" the friend exclaimed. Margot, now 10 months old, could stand without holding on, but was pretty shaky. On the 18th of October, Mom received good news at her group health checkup. Her heart function had improved slightly, undoubtedly from the strict diet and careful exercise regimen she followed. Her potassium level was on the low side, however, so her doctor prescribed Slow K to keep the level up. To further improve the condition, she was told to eat bananas and drink orange juice daily. In Seattle that day, however, Mom and Jan rode with an insane taxi cab driver who drove too fast and cornered over the edges of sidewalks, causing pedestrians to jump clear. Another matter unsettled my mother as well, since she was taking her wedding ring to a jeweler that day to have it reduced. Her fingers had become extremely thin from weight loss. It was the first time in 36 years she'd had to leave it anywhere. When we saw Dad that evening, he said that the casting call had gone out on the Dune movie, and that all parts were set with the exception of the three leading roles of Paul Atreides, Lady Jessica, and the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam. The base of operations was uncertain, but the desert scenes would be filmed in the Salamayuca Desert in Mexico, since Mexican peso devaluations made it economically attractive. Dad said that the Lazarus effect was finished, and that it was a substantial improvement over the Jesus incident, where he and Bill Ransom had experienced plot and characterization difficulties. The next morning, my parents left for Hawaii, planning to remain until spring. On their second day there, Dad called to say that he had forgotten their passports in Port Townsend, which they needed for a romantic Christmas trip to Samoa and Bora Bora. I promised to retrieve them, along with other items that Mom wanted sent to her. He said he was in tennis shorts looking out at two mountain peaks on the Big Island of Hawaii, Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa. It was 84 degrees, and they were about to leave for dinner at the elegant Hotel Hanamaui. A month later, by the 17th of November, I had typed 170 pages of the client's survival manual. That evening, Margot took her first steps, 5 of them. Her steps were extremely hesitant and uncertain, with no bending of the knees at all. In the manner of a tightrope walker, she had her arms extended at her sides for balance. Dad called when we were getting ready for bed. It was 3 hours earlier in Hawaii. He was 80 pages into a new manuscript, Heretics of Dune, 5th in the Dune series. They had decided not to go to Samoa or Bora Bora after all, as he was in the middle of a book and did not want to leave it. I heard Segovia classical guitar music in the background from his extensive reel-to-reel collection. Mom came on the line and said she hoped he would change his mind about the South Seas trip. They never did go, and later I learned it was really because of the constant cash flow problems. The trip was on the frivolous side. Early in December, I spoke with Mom by telephone about Christmas gifts for the children. She said Honolulu was a 2-bit town for shopping. "It's not like the places I've seen," she said. "Oh, the places I've seen." The way she said this brought to mind exotic, colorful marketplaces all over the world. It also made me think of an entry in Leto II's journal in God Emperor of Dune. "Oh, the landscapes I have seen. And the people." She was depressed about spending the holidays away from family and said, "Give the girls a big hug for me." "I can see your arms stretching across the Pacific to us," I said. "Well, they are," she responded. 4 days before Christmas, my father called. He said their Christmas tree was a 5 or 6 inch high Hawaiian bush with ornaments on it. The De Laurentiis people were building sets now, with a $56 million projected film budget, substantially more than earlier estimates. After changing their minds a number of times, the producers had decided to film the entire motion picture in Mexico because of Mexican peso devaluations. They hoped to release it in the spring or summer of 1984. I asked Dad how many pesos there were in $56 million. His answer? Muchísimo. Very many. Chapter 34. her warrior spirit. Early in January 1983, I finished the client's survival manual, nearly 500 pages, and dispatched it to Clyde Taylor in New York. I had heard my father speak of needing to get a manuscript out the door, getting it finished and out of sight for the sake of sanity, and now I knew what he meant. I set to work on a new science fiction novel, Sudana Sudana, about an alien planetoid where music was outlawed. Around this time, I spoke with Dad by telephone. He and Mom had just returned from a tiring trip to Carmel in San Francisco. Mom had gone in for medical checkups before and after the trip, and the deterioration of her heart muscle had slowed. This was bittersweet news, since it was still deteriorating. While in San Francisco, my father wandered into a Market Street bookstore as a customer, and as he did occasionally, he began removing copies of his books from the racks and signing them. Suddenly the clerk, a huffy young man, rushed over and said, "Now see here, what do you think you're doing?" "I'm autographing these books, of course," came the response, in an erudite tone. And Dad pulled another book down from the shelf, a hardcover edition of Children of Doom. On the title page, he drew a line through his name and scrawled his signature with practiced strokes. "You'll have to stop, sir," the clerk exclaimed, believing him to be a pretender, perhaps even a megalomaniac. "But I'm Frank Herbert." The clerk didn't believe him, not even when Dad held the photograph of himself on the back cover of Children of Dune next to his face. It wasn't until the bearded man produced identification, including a raft of credit cards, that he was finally believed. Then the poor fellow became the most embarrassed, apologetic person on the face of the earth. Dad told me he was 90 pages into the first draft of Heretics of Dune. He referred to it as the one all the money's riding on. He said Mom and one of the caretakers, Sheila, were planting poinsettias for Jan on the hillside just outside the kitchen window. Poinsettias had been important to my wife since childhood, when she placed them at the base of a statue of the Virgin Mary and prayed for her mother to recover from an illness. Reportedly, a miracle had occurred. Over the years, my mother had given Jan poinsettia gifts in a variety of forms, from tablecloths and napkins bearing the design to live plants. Now Beverly Herbert wanted to present her daughter-in-law with fresh flowers when we went to visit. Mom had also been looking for information on cruise ships for me, and had found a couple that she was anxious to tell me about. On Sunday, January 9th, 1983, Dad called and told me angrily about an attempt by Chilton Books to assert an interest in the Dune movie, despite having waived all such rights when Putnam became the hardcover publisher of Dune. I asked him if there might be loopholes in the waiver, and he said there were none to his knowledge. "I'm going to put a Philadelphia lawyer in his place," he said, referring to the attorney representing Chilton. My father said he was putting in long hours on the new novel, pressing to complete it as soon as possible. That morning, as usual, he rose before dawn and worked out on a rowing machine and exercise. Then a quick shower and a light breakfast of toast and guava juice, which he took to his study. He took a large number of vitamins each day. For years, Dad had been on a regimen of 12 to 15 vitamins daily. Bottles of them were lined up on the bathroom counter. Since vitamin A was retained in the body and he could overdose on it, he took it every other day. And since vitamin D came from the sun, he took it on alternate days while in Hawaii and daily on the mainland. He said that every person should take a different quantity of vitamin C, and that it had to be taken with vitamin B for best assimilation. He based this on the fact that some people needed 60 milligrams a day to avoid scurvy, while others needed only 5 milligrams. He said each person could determine his proper amount by loading up on the vitamin until the stool started to loosen, and then backing off a little on the dosage. When vitamin E became popular in the early 1980s, ostensibly for its ability to inhibit the aging process, both of my parents took it. They found an additional property for it as well, which my mother described for me. A gelatin capsule of vitamin E could be opened and spread on a cut, she said, in order to make it heal faster. After riding for 3 hours, he helped Mom get ready for the day. He made her hot cream of wheat with sliced bananas on top, found books and knitting materials and art supplies and whatever else she needed, and by 9:30 he was back at his desk. He was using a compact word processor now instead of a typewriter, since it was much faster. Each night he put the computer away in a dry room to prevent it from being damaged so quickly by salt air. My mother was sitting outside in the sun as he spoke, with a sketch pad on her lap, painting lush flowers from their garden. During this time, I performed the usual chores for my parents, involving insurance, maintaining their car, straightening out bank accounts, and tracking down items that they could not locate in Hawaii. A number of telephone calls came in as well, from people looking for them. I played Moat Dragon by screening the inquiries, so that Mom and Dad would not be disturbed unnecessarily. In mid-January, I spoke with my parents, with each of them on an extension phone. After listening to Dad for several minutes, I asked my mother what she had been doing to keep busy. "Checking up on your father," she said with a chuckle. "It used to be easier when he wrote with a typewriter, but now he has a word processor and I have to listen carefully for the keys." Dad laughed. "How are you feeling, Mom?" I asked. "Oh, fine, fine." She sounded cheerful, with a hint of the giggly little girl cuteness she could exude at times. Dad spoke of a party they had been to, and how easy it was in Hawaii to eat and drink to excess and get too much sun. He suggested a book we might write together in a year or so. It would be nonfiction, with a working title of Looking for America. The book would examine American myths, including reminiscences and comparisons, discussing how far off course we had drifted. I expressed interest, keeping in mind occasional discussions we'd had to do a humor book or cookbook together. Such discussions had petered out, but in retrospect, I hadn't pressed them, and my father had to be the busiest man on the planet. I learned later that Mom had been encouraging him to write a book with me. I discovered as well that she wanted to sell Xanadu, the Port Townsend house, and purchase a waterfront place on Mercer Island near us. At her urging, they planned to begin looking for the house upon returning to the mainland. "I love the water," she said. It was all part of a secret and well-thought-out plan she had, one that would become increasingly evident to all of us. In mid-February, after experiencing plot problems on my new novel, I was beginning to build up a head of steam. I was sitting at the typewriter when Mom called. "I called for nothing," she said. "I was thinking about you guys. Missing you." We discussed Sydney's comet. She was anxious to see it in book form. I told her I received a color proof of the cover art several days earlier and would make a copy for her. Publication was scheduled for June. Dad came on the line for a few moments and said he was on page 366 of Heretics of Dune, out of a projected 500. This was only 46 pages better than a month earlier, and he said he had run into plot problems, slowing him down. I learned later that Mom had not been feeling well in recent weeks, with nausea and loss of appetite, as well as abdominal pains from serious fluid accumulation in the peritoneal cavity. Dad had been required to take her to the Hana Medical Clinic almost every day, and Dr. Howell, thinking her medications might be causing her discomfiture, reduced her medications. This, however, resulted in a severe loss of energy, and the medications were reinstituted. Dad didn't tell me these things with Mom nearby, as she didn't like him sharing too much detail about her condition, fearing it would make us worry. But the next day, a Monday, Dad phoned me at work and said, "I don't want you to think this is a big medical emergency, Brian, but we may be back in 3 days. Dr. Howell wanted Group Health Hospital in Redmond, near Seattle, to monitor her blood condition and other vital signs to see how her body chemistry was reacting to medication. They had to balance it carefully. The doctor was checking with his mainland counterparts on this, and a flight was being arranged. My father wanted me to pick them up at SeaTac Airport on Thursday, February 24th, and said they needed to stay with us. But he was rattled, and called me before knowing the flight schedule. I was worried about him, knowing how difficult it was for him to be pulled out of the middle of a book. I heard my mother's voice in the background, rather a high tone, and Dad paused to listen to her. "I'll be right back," he said to me. The receiver thumped as he set it down. Presently, Dad returned, saying Mom got a shot from Dr. Howell and was complaining that her thigh hurt. I heard her say something about not wanting to climb the stairs to the bedrooms in our house. She might stay in the hospital, Dad said, and he would stay with us. My mother was unhappy, too, about having to leave Kawaloa. Afterward, Jan and I spoke about how unfortunate it was that they had chosen to live in such a remote part of the world, with Mom needing so much medical care. Hana was good for my mother's soul, but the decision to live there had been emotional, not thought out well. I didn't sleep well that night, and learned in the morning that Jan and I had said separate prayers for Mom. On the evening of the 24th, we drove Mom straight to Group Health Hospital in Redmond. I had a color proof of the Sydney's Comet cover in the car and showed it to them. It depicted a fiery orange and yellow comet against a starry backdrop of space. It was a comet composed of Earth's own jettisoned garbage, coming back to destroy the planet. We checked Mom into the hospital. She had been experiencing abdominal pains, and according to tests performed in Hawaii, had minor fluid accumulations in her abdomen and liver. One of the nurses asked her to list all the medications she was on, and Mom rattled off 4 or 5. Dad went with her to X-ray, made sure the phone in her room was hooked up, and explained details of her condition to the nurses and a doctor. It took over 2 hours, and we did not arrive home until nearly 1:30 a.m. On the drive to our house, Dad said the Dune movie should be completed by 1984, but perhaps not until late in the year. He said the dispute with Chilton over movie rights had been settled out of court, with Dad paying 37.5% and Putnam the balance. The problem was a clause in the contract that gave Chilton three-dimensional reproduction rights. Dad asked what it meant at the time, and recalled being told that it referred to movie promotional items, such as pop-up books and T-shirts. The Chilton lawyers used this clause, in my father's words, to harass the movie production, and he thought they might have to be paid around $75,000 under the settlement agreement. We discussed the America book we were going to do. He spoke passionately about the blunders of existing governmental systems. Whenever he started talking about politics, he had a lot to say. Millions of readers knew this from the Dune sequels in particular, where the characters spoke at length about power and politics, didactically at times. Frank Herbert was, after all, a teacher. He was a staunch believer in America and in democracy, but his active mind envisioned any number of improvements that might be made to the system. One of them involved what he called a national jury democracy, or national town meeting, in which governmental power would be taken away from politicians and bureaucrats in favor of the citizenry. The U.S. House and Senate, and similar state institutions, would be eliminated entirely, with their veto power transferred to the electorate. Under a nationwide jury system linked by computer, the electorate would be given the power to veto any decision, any policy made by their leaders. It didn't matter what governors or even the president of the United States said. The people would have a direct voice in everything. My father went on to say that he wanted to remove entrenched functionaries, that the American bureaucracy needed to be radically overhauled. In an incredulous tone, he told the story of a Washington, D.C. bureaucrat who had been ensconced in his position for more than 4 decades. Like many others, he could not be fired. Incredibly, the bureaucrat referred to members of the U.S. House and Senate as transients. The morning after our brainstorming session, a Friday, Dad was up at dawn, on his way to the hospital to see Mom. She spent the day traveling between Redmond and Seattle by cabulance for the various tests she needed. Her abdomen had flattened out, and she was feeling better. He'd gone to a department store at noon, skipping lunch, and bought her a warm robe. At our house that evening, Dad talked about his childhood and what he knew of Mom's, and frequently his eyes missed it over. But he kept on, as if trying to recapture halcyon, simpler times. Dad, Julie, and I visited Mom that evening. She looked nice in the new light blue robe he had given her. On the way home, Dad gave us ominous news. He said she had cardiomyopathy and pneumonitis, linked to the radiation treatments of 1974, with only 60-65% of her normal heart and lung functions remaining. Most of the right side of her heart had collapsed. She would be checking out of the hospital soon, and he was arranging for her to have oxygen at home when she slept. A home unit would convert ambient air to 95% pure oxygen. Since the heart produces oxygen for the body, he explained, Mom needed more oxygen to supplement the loss of function. He thought the best they could hope for was for the heart to remain stable, or eventually the condition would kill her. There are no guarantees in this life, he told me. At least Mom has had a better life than many people, I said. He thought for a moment, then said in a determined voice, It's not over yet. On Saturday, February 26th, 1983, Frank Herbert woke up at around 4 o'clock in the morning and telephoned the hospital to check on his wife. She'd had a good night's sleep, according to the nurse on duty. when I saw him later that morning. He had a 1-inch gash on top of his forehead. He had been sleeping in our carriage house room under a low overhang and whacked his head when he sat up too quickly. Dad and I went to see Mom at around 11 a.m. On the way, he said Mom's best hope might lie in ongoing research into the body's immune system. If certain problems could be resolved, she might be able to receive a heart transplant. Up to that time, only a few hundred transplants had taken place in the entire world, and many of the patients had died when their immune systems did not accept the new organ, or when other complications set in, such as pneumonia. Dad said he had to do all of the cooking now, as Mom did not have the energy. He was feeling pretty tired himself, suffering his usual jet lag on top of everything else. He brought his manuscript along, but hadn't been able to touch it. "I'm too wrung out to write," he said. At our house that evening, Dad was showing Kim and me how to prepare one of his favorite meals, oyster sauce beef. He took a call from his film agent, Ned Brown, in the midst of this and told him how Mom was doing. In some detail, they discussed a complete waiver that was being signed by Chilton Books, at the conclusion of which my father said, "Right on. They'll hold me blameless for everything and will never sue me, even if I urinate on them." Later at the hospital, Mom asked about the cut on Dad's head, which she hadn't noticed previously because of the effects of her medication. "It's not serious," he responded. "Just a little hole." Dad sat with Mom on the bed. He was a little too clumsy for her this time, however, with his arm around her shoulder so that it hurt her neck, and leaning against her so that she had trouble breathing. With a girlish giggle, she dispatched him to his chair. When we were about to leave, Dad leaned close to Mom and held her hand, telling her he loved her and adding, "I wish you were with me." "Why?" she asked, looking at the cut on his forehead. "Then I'd have a hole in my head, too." On the drive home, Dad said his income had doubled in a short period of time, but mentioned what I had heard before, that they were still having a great deal of trouble keeping up with expenses. I offered to loan him $30,000 or $40,000 if that would help, but he said that would hardly touch his financial obligations. "I'll keep your offer in mind," he said, "but I think I can pry something loose from my publishers." During the next week, Dad stayed with us most nights, but at least half the time he slept at the hospital near Mom, in a waiting room or on a cot they set up for him. Jan and I visited Mom every day. To outward appearances, she seemed too healthy to be in the hospital, and I was hopeful for her. She told me Dad was always making sure she had everything, and if anything was lacking or slow in arriving, he went in search of a nurse. He even monitored the medications she was receiving and asked doctors and nurses to explain the purpose of each one and the dosages. "Sometimes he orders the nurses around," Mom said with a smile, "as if he were a doctor." Just before we checked Mom out of the hospital in early March, Dad told me the doctors only gave her 2 years to live. "I think she'll live longer," he added in a resolute tone. "She's fooled the experts before." I was shaking, and he comforted me. A few days later, the telephone rang at my office, and I answered with my name. To this, she replied, "Hello, Brian Herbert." She sounded surprisingly good, and it comforted me. She was in Port Townsend and said Dad had been interviewed that morning by the New York Times. She had been to her doctor in Port Townsend, giving blood for a sample he needed. I asked what else she had been doing during the week. "Just giving blood," she said. "I've been paying bills." "Are you swimming?" I inquired. "Starting again," she said. "Your father is helping me." Among Dad's many ideas in recent years, he had mentioned the possibility of setting up a family compound near Issaquah, just east of Seattle. But Mom had her own input, which differed. They spent a day in the middle of March with a realtor, looking at houses on Mercer Island and in nearby Bellevue. They wanted a rambler due to Mom's exertion problem. No stairs. Jan went with them and told me afterward that Mom had trouble breathing under the slightest exertion. They didn't find a house that they liked. That evening we went to dinner at a gourmet restaurant on Mercer Island, and I noticed the breathing noises my mother was making too. I held her arm and walked with her from the car to the table. She seemed so delicate and small, but she was cheerful and smiled at me frequently. At the table, I helped her out of her elegant long black coat. She wore a lavender Missoni dress and a pearl necklace with matching earrings. A gold Swiss watch adorned her left wrist. I told Dad that for a couple of weeks I had been worrying about books I had in New York in search of publishers, the Garbage Chronicles and the Client's Survival Manual. I was quick to add that I was at work on a new novel, Sudana Sudana, and this pleased him. On Monday, March 28, 1983, Dad was scheduled to fly to Mexico City to operate the clapboard for the first scene of the Dune movie. Mom had planned to go, but her doctors felt that the altitude there, 7,350 feet, and severe air pollution could make it difficult for her to breathe. Consequently, she would remain home. Deeply disappointed at not being able to be with him on such a momentous occasion, she was grouchy the whole week that he was gone. Jan shifted her school schedule around to be with Mom, and arrived in Port Townsend just before Dad left. He explained my mother's dietary needs to Jan, and her exercise program, with this caution: "You have to stay with her every second in the pool." A strong swimmer, Jan told him not to worry. Max von Sydow, Jose Ferrer, Jürgen Prochnow, Linda Hunt, and Sting would be in the cast, and they add a new actor for the leading role of Paul Atreides, Kyle MacLachlan, a recent graduate of the University of Washington Acting School. He had played Shakespearean parts, including Octavius Caesar and Romeo, and when discovered by a Dune casting agent, was playing in the Empty Space Theater's production of Tartuffe in Seattle. MacLachlan, signed to a multi-picture deal for more stories in the Dune series, had been a fan of Dune since reading it at the age of 12 or 13. Remarkably, he had sometimes fantasized about playing the part of Paul. Two screen tests were required before he won the coveted role, one in Los Angeles and the second in Mexico City. I spoke with Dad on the telephone early in April after he arrived home. He was not feeling well, having contracted what he termed mal de la país, meaning the ill of the country. He was euphoric nonetheless, saying that the movie production was going extremely well. He said he had dined with Sean Phillips, Richard Jordan, Jose Ferrer, and other members of the cast. The filming was taking place at Churubusco Studios, near the site of the 1968 Olympic Games. Dad got to keep the clapboard from the very first take of the first scene, after he clicked it to start the cameras rolling. Later the film crew would shoot desert scenes in the Salamayuca Desert of northern Mexico. "I shot off the starting pistol," my father said. Frank Herbert was pleased with the way that David Lynch was directing the project. "David understands the essence of my book," Dad said. "He's translated my swashbuckler to the language of film." He said that half a dozen people recognized him on the plane coming home, and he suspected it would get worse after the movie came out. This comment was based not only on the general publicity, but on the fact that he might do an Alfred Hitchcock-style cameo appearance in the movie. Some people were suggesting that he shave off his beard to protect his privacy. To this he replied, steadfastly, "No way. It's my trademark." He also said there was continued strong interest from Paramount Pictures about doing The White Plague as a movie, and that he'd been on the telephone with his film agent Ned Brown about that recently. On Monday, April 11th, Clyde Taylor called from New York with fantastic news. He said Berkeley Books wanted to publish The Garbage Chronicles. After listening to an account of their offer, which he thought was satisfactory, I told him to accept. The following Saturday, we arrived in Port Townsend just before noon. The new Hood Canal floating bridge was completed and open, making the trip a lot easier and saving at least an hour of travel time. That afternoon, my father and I discussed our collaboration, the book about America. He had some intriguing ideas and showed enthusiasm for a number of my suggestions. He also said to me, "You'll establish your name as a novelist. In fact, from what I've been hearing out of New York, you already have." Margot ran around getting into things all day, with my mother and the rest of us saying constantly, "No, no." Finally, Mom quipped, "I've always wanted the kids to call me Nana, but I'm afraid this one is going to think my name is No, No." The following morning, I arose before dawn and went up to Dad's loft study, where I typed a couple of pages of America notes from the previous day's discussion. He had a big Olympia typewriter on a side table, in addition to the computer and printer, which were set up on the desk. Dad came upstairs just as I was finishing. He wore a blue terry cloth robe with the script initials FH embroidered in gold on the pocket. His blonde hair was wet and slicked back from swimming. "I thought I heard my typewriter going," he said. My father scanned the notes, then slapped them down on the desk and said, "Good. I'll add to them later. You want some orange juice?" "Sure." We squeezed half a dozen oranges in his big manual press on the kitchen counter, poured the juice in glasses, and drank quickly before the vitamin C dissipated. "I did 40 laps this morning," he said. "About average." For him, perhaps, but not for most 62-year-old men. He gave me a cast list for the movie, showing a number of names we hadn't discussed before, including Dean Stockwell, Francesca Annis, and Dino De Laurentiis's wife, Silvana Mangano, who had been a renowned beauty in her youth. Dad said he and Mom were getting a percentage on sales of movie tickets, and a different percentage on toys, dolls, coloring books, and other products. Emerging from the master bedroom, Mom joined the conversation. She had ideas for a fuzzy stuffed worm and a breakfast cereal called Melange, after the precious spice of Dune. "I'm taking your mother to the movies next year," Dad added. "Our movie." She beamed. We were getting ready to leave for home when Margot slipped into Mom's office and flipped on her electric typewriter. Dad got pretty mad about this and yelled at Julie and Kim for not keeping a better watch on their little sister. Later that month, my mother telephoned me at work while I was assembling a vegetarian sandwich on my desktop. She said excitedly that Sidney's Comet had just received a rave review from Publishers Weekly, a prestigious literary publication. This was a total surprise to me, as my book hadn't been published yet. Scheduled for June, I had been told it might be out as early as May. Mom said they must have reviewed an advanced reading copy of the book and said it was a significant step in my new career. "We're very proud of you," she said. Dad got on the line and said something kind of corny, that I liked anyway. "That's my boy." Clyde Taylor called from New York that afternoon and read the review to me. Then he mailed me a copy. It read, in part, "The son of Frank Herbert has produced a fine first work, a carefully crafted social satire written with maturity, empathy, and a dark wit. Herbert's work is unusually inventive and original. He displays real talent." 2 weeks later, I received copies of the book in the mail and began distributing signed copies to my family. On the title page, I crossed off my name and signed next to it, just as my father did. It had become a family tradition. My mother was driving the Mercedes coupe now, giving her a degree of independence. She did pretty well, except for one day toward the end of May 1983, when she hit a garden stake with a nail on it that gouged paint along the bottom of one of the car doors. I took information on the claim for her. On Thursday, June 2nd, Dad called to say a local bookstore wanted him to sign several boxes of his books for a special Frank Herbert display. He asked me to pick up the books and bring them to him. After work, I picked up 11 boxes containing a mixture of his titles. The next day, we arrived in Port Townsend at 5:30 p.m. It was cooler than it had been, around 60 degrees and overcast. Only a few days before, the Pacific Northwest experienced record temperatures in the high 80s and low 90s. Mom was reading Dad's just-completed fifth Dune novel when we walked in. She was seated in one of the dark yellow recliner chairs in the sitting area adjacent to the kitchen, with manuscript pages spread out on the table beside her. She said it was great, that she couldn't put it down. She felt each book in the series was better than the one before, with plots and characterizations that were even better than Dune. Dad said his newest, Heretics of Dune, was at least 200,000 words and had gone beyond his earlier 500-page manuscript projections. The words would probably be trimmed to 180,000 by Victoria Shockett, the freelance editor working on the project for Berkeley Putnam. Victoria Shockett, the wife of noted author Eric Van Lustbader. I went outside and brought the boxes of books into the basement, through the garage. Dad sat at a table and signed half the books, while I unpacked and repacked them. He signed each title page with a flourish, after first crossing out his printed name. During our meal, my mother said it was unusual that I was selling novels without first having sold short stories. I told her I had incorporated one of my short stories, Earth Games, into the Garbage Chronicles as a chapter. After dinner, I was pouring Grand Marnier for the adults, while Jan was helping Mom and Dad in the kitchen with the dinner dishes. Suddenly, all hell broke loose. Margot, a year and a half old, was in the living room and had gotten into some Dune movie slides the Dad had brought back from Mexico City. She made finger marks on many of them, and Dad said these marks had acid in them and would never come out. He was furious, though he probably should not have left the slides on a coffee table with a toddler running around. He tried to blame Kim for not watching Margot, when suddenly Jan erupted in tears and told my father it was as much his fault as anyone's. She said it would be impossible to keep the baby out of their other things and that perhaps it would be better if we left right then and went home. Mom calmed Jan down, and Dad said he was sorry for blowing up. Several times afterward, though, he muttered, "She was walking on them. I can't believe she was walking on them." But gradually, things settled down, and we stayed. Children, my father's bête noire. Dad put the Mexico slides in a projector, set up a screen, and showed them to us. The pictures showed the Dune movie sets along with many of the production people. De Laurentiis and Lynch were assembling a crew of 900, along with 39 principal actors and a cast of 20,000 extras. There would be 75 sets and 8 sound stages, and 4 exotic planets would be depicted. Some of the scenes would be filmed in 120-degree desert heat. Dad said they would not be doing the famous banquet scene from his book due to time and budgetary constraints. He disagreed with this decision, but did not seem visibly upset by it. In a determined tone, Mom said she would go with him on the next movie trip, come hell or high water, as she felt she was missing out on all the fun. She swam almost an entire pool length before we arrived, the best she had done since returning to the mainland earlier in the year. I got the feeling she was highly motivated, the way she'd been when she first discovered she had lung cancer back in 1974. She had a warrior's spirit. All of us had seen Sidney's Comet next to Dad's books in bookstores. Both Mom and Jan were always rearranging our books, making sure they were neat and moving them up to eye level, displaying them more prominently. Jan mentioned receiving a telephone call in January from a science fiction writer wanting to reach Dad. She said the fellow was rude, couldn't wait to get past her. "He was abrupt with me," Jan said, "treated me like a bump. So the next time I saw his books in a store, I moved them to the back and put Herbert books in front of them." "Revenge of the Bump," I said. "What a title," Dad exclaimed. While I was running an errand with my mother the next day, she quipped that she was married to Imhotep, the pyramid builder, with all of the construction projects he had going on all the time. I thought back on my father's life. His Vashon Island, Washington house hadn't been completed. Neither had a home remodel in Cloverdale, California. A houseboat project turned into a near disaster, financially and otherwise, as it strained relations with two of his closest friends. Then Dad purchased the Port Townsend place, and building activity reached new heights for him. He was forever giving me tours of the property and pointing out the changes he had in mind. Frank Herbert enjoyed showing visitors around, be they friends, family members, or interviewers. He was always looking toward the future, toward what he hoped to build soon. No matter how much he completed, there was always more to come. And this was appropriate, I imagine, since he was a man of the future. Now Kawaloa on far-off Maui was in a category of its own, way beyond anything he had attempted previously. And once it was built, what then? He wasn't only like Imhotep, I told Mom. He was like William Randolph Hearst, another powerful man who always had construction projects going on around him. My father liked the ongoing activity as a creative outlet when he had finished writing for the day. "I hadn't thought of it quite that way," she said, "but I think you're absolutely right." As I turned onto the gravel road, I saw her nodding her head. She glanced at me, said, "You've become very observant, Brian." I figured him out with my journal. "Good," she said. "And I suppose you've figured me out that way, too?" "I'm still working on you," I replied, with a laugh. My parents planned to spend their 37th wedding anniversary together in Mexico City and were flying there on June 17th. We got together with them the night before in Seattle. Mom had been working hard on her conditioning program, improving her cardiovascular system to the maximum it could be. Doctors were concerned about the altitude of Mexico City and the terrible air pollution there, but she pressed to go. Finally, they relented. They were absolutely amazed at how well she was doing, considering the damage they knew had been done to her heart from radiation treatment to cure lung cancer. She could swim 2 laps of the pool now, and almost half a lap underwater. Universal Pictures was paying for the trip and for visits to the movie set by leading film distributors. The studio was spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, Dad said, for all the people they were bringing to Mexico City. My parents' trip to Mexico this time differed markedly from an earlier excursion in 1955 to 56, when we were poor and had to return to the U.S. nearly penniless, in a hearse with bald tires, our family car. After the return of my parents from Mexico in early July 1983, we picked them up at the Red Lion Inn in the Seattle suburb of Bellevue and took them to dinner at a French restaurant. Mom looked good, but admitted feeling a little tired. Dad said she was continuing to improve. He put his arm around her at the table and said she swam laps at our hotel at 8,000 feet. Mexico City was at 7,350 feet, but I said nothing. I knew what he was saying, that she had done well with her exercises at altitude, where the air was thinner and exertion more difficult. Not to mention the pollution. And she's up to 4 laps at home now, he said. 4.5, Mom said proudly. 2 big parties had been given while they were in Mexico City, and they met many cast members. My parents sensed charisma in the handsome young actor playing Paul Atreides, Kyle MacLachlan, and thought he'd have to be on the alert for groupies. They saw 3.5 hours of the first Prince of Film called Rushes. Filming was 60% done and should be completed around September. The editing, scoring, special effects, and other finishing touches would take quite a bit of time after that, and the production staff thought it might be released to the public no earlier than June 1984. Dad tossed around some staggering 8-figure numbers in terms of income he expected to receive from the film, and said he wanted to use a small portion of it, a few million, to set up a foundation for the study of social systems, with the goal of setting the American bureaucracy on a new course. He said he had been plotting the 6th book in the Dune series for several days, while I was around 60% through my new novel, Sudana Sudana. I had been working on it since February. At least once a week, Mom and Dad came south from Port Townsend to look for a house in the Seattle area, hoping to find that waterfront piece on Mercer Island. They found a house that my mother loved, only a few blocks from our place on Mercer Island. A sprawling, single-level home with Japanese architecture and landscaping, it featured a fine view of Lake Washington, but was not waterfront. They submitted an offer, and on the day it went in, Mom told Jan how much she hoped they could get that house. But my father had his own price in mind, substantially lower than the asking price. He lowballed the place, making such a bargain basement offer that it angered the sellers and the deal fell apart. When Jan told me about this, about how much my mother wanted that house, I blew up. Jan had been going around with them looking for real estate for weeks, helping in every way possible. Now, after all the trouble, Dad had blown the deal. I called him and expressed my displeasure in no uncertain terms. He didn't have much to say, but somehow after I hung up, it resulted in Mom crying about the whole thing. I don't know how much I contributed to the upset, and how much of her unhappiness was from losing the house. In any event, Dad called me back, and we had a less emotional conversation. I'm not totally lost in a maze, he said to me. I found this comment somewhat perplexing, and thought about it afterward without coming up with an answer. Only later, much later, would I realize what was truly going on. Mom was convinced she was dying, and wanted to be certain Dad had a home near Jan and me, so that we could care for him. The year before, she had expressed concern to Jan so poignantly. I worry most about Frank. We've always been like one person. When I go, what will happen to him? After her poor medical diagnosis, she began formulating a plan, assuring herself that the members of her family would be taken care of if she was not around. The Mercer Island house was part of it. In a related part of the plan, she was encouraging him to write a book with me, perhaps more than one, so he would be kept busy and wouldn't have time to get depressed. A place to live near loved ones, and work to keep him busy. Other pieces of her plan would emerge soon. Dad's comment about not being totally lost in a maze came because he knew exactly what she was doing. If he purchased property near us, it seemed tantamount to an admission on his part that Mom was not going to make it. So he lowballed the place and lost it. I think Dad would have found something wrong with any house on Mercer Island. He was also extremely hesitant to sell the Port Townsend farm. He had put too much work into Xanadu, too much love. It fulfilled some of his most closely held lifelong dreams. Frank Herbert could not have a farm on a Mercer Island lot. It was a highly suburbanized area with comparatively small pieces of property, and neighbors that would not understand ducks running around and roosters crowing at the break of dawn. Chapter 35. My Mother's Plan. In late July 1983, Frank Herbert told me that he typed 100 rough draft pages on Dune 6, as yet unnamed, in just 4 days. I didn't dare ask, but I had seen some of his rough drafts done single space. In contrast, it had taken me 6 months to write 152 rough draft pages of Sudana Sudana double spaced. He said he normally spent 600 to 800 hours on a completed novel. His contract on Dune 6 was in the stratosphere, providing him with even more money than the astounding figure he had received for Dune 5, Heretics of Dune. Around this time, Jan and I went to a dinner dance with my parents, where the entertainment was a small combo that played music ranging from the 1940s to modern popular selections. Mom and I had one slow dance together. While a little short of breath, she was laughing like a schoolgirl when I led her back to the table. The following month, Mom decided she wanted to start a newsletter, reviewing Seattle restaurants as well as restaurants from their travels. She planned to call it BA, using her own initials, and wanted Jan and me to eat at restaurants and provide her with reports. I suggested the use of a form for the criticisms, an idea she liked. Dad and I offered to help edit the newsletter, while Jan said she would be the chief eater. Mom said we were the only people, along with Dad, that she was telling about the idea. Late that evening after Dad had gone to bed, Mom told me that if the newsletter got off the ground, it would be the first time she ever got her name on a publication. I asked her about a romance story she had sold in the 1940s, a plan-ahead book she worked on for the Retail Reporting Bureau, and a number of Christmas stories she had written for department store promotions, all of which were published. "My romance story was published anonymously," she said, "and the other writings, well, they weren't very significant. They were part of my job, part of structures I didn't create. This newsletter would be a big step for me. I plan to have fun with it." Our first foray for Ba was the elegant Mirabeau restaurant a few days later.